You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Everybody, welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and I am with Nishant Mehta. Nishant Mehta, thank you. Hi, Nishant. How are you?
I'm doing well, David. It's good to see you again.
Yes, you as well. Good to see you. And Truth in Advertising, I should say that I met Nishant at a workshop he conducted for the school I co-founded years ago, and I was not looking forward to it. Because how many workshops can you go to over the years? And I was happily surprised. It was both a fun and informative and I think really productive and useful day. So anyway, thank you. And thanks for giving up the time to do this.
It's my pleasure, David. I'm glad that you had a good time because I definitely had a good time working with you and the rest of the team, you know, on that Saturday. And it was a really good opportunity to do some productive, meaningful work on behalf of institution I know you obviously deeply care about and types of institutions I deeply care about.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, it really was. It was good. I hope more comes of it. And you never know with those things. It's that world. So let me just give a brief bio, barely, and you can add anything I left out that feels like it's important. Nishant is an educator, sort of in his core, and has been a teacher and an administrator at an independent school. He was the head of school of the children's school, which is located in Atlanta, Georgia. He was the head of school for 7 years. And he now, you are now a consultant, but you may call yourself something different. And the name of his company is Metacognition. And, well, I'll let you speak about it. So other than a clever use of play on words of meta and meta, Metacognition is also about metacognition. So what is it? What do you guys do? And what should people know about Metacognition, the company?
So as you said, you know, I was a teacher, administrator, and head of school, you know, for a number of years. And consultant is the way, you know, it's a very generic term. It's not a term I like a lot, but it's what works because people understand it.
Yes.
But really at its core, you know, when I think about metacognition and the work that we do, it's really about the partnership with leaders and specifically individuals and teams. So what are we really focused on? Our focus is really about three things and looking at whatever we do through the lens of these three things: culture, strategy, and talent. And I consider that, you know, for us, you know, the piece of culture, which is really not only who you are, but more importantly, how you behave, how you show up, how do you live into the values and the mission that you promise, that you commit on your website and in your materials and on a day-to-day basis. And so it's less about the words, but it's more about the actions. And we think about culture in those terms of really how you live into something and you live into it on a daily basis. It's one of those things when we think about culture, it's almost like the word integrity. It's that you know it when you see it. It's what you do when no one's looking. And so culture is one of those things. It's like the waters in which you swim. The second part, of course, is strategy, which is, go ahead, David.
No, I was just going to say, did you ever bump into, and I should say, I know the primary focus of what you, of the work of Metacognition is or has been educational institutions, schools. But I know that's not the only thing. But have you ever bumped into, has anybody invited you in and you speak about culture and they don't actually know what you mean? I mean, they have some idea what the word culture means, but they are hard pressed to talk about the culture of their institutions. Do you run into that?
We run into that all the time. It's a great question, David. I think, you know, this definition at times that I use for culture that you'll find out there in the literature is, well, it's the way we do things around here. The problem is when you ask people, well, what is the way you do things around there? A lot of times folks don't necessarily have the clarity with which to describe it. It's a little bit of, I'll know it when I see it. And more often than not, people will describe culture as, well, actually, I will tell you what not to do because I'll more likely be able to see something that I don't think I want or we do. And I'll say, well, David, that's not the way we do things around here. So, you know, it's a little bit of times like we use it or think of it or define it as something punitive, if you will, as opposed to something positive or something we live more positively into on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
The definition is I think it's an important place to begin, right? It's an important place to begin because if the second part of what we do is around strategy, right? And the Peter Drucker adage of culture eats strategy for breakfast. So often we find that, you know, the reasons why strategies fail in so many institutions is because it goes back to the question you just asked. It's because people don't understand or have really understood their culture at its core. So you end up focusing on strategy when really make sure you have clarity of culture.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And it's I think a lot of times people do that. They people in schools are often very smart people. And so they can come up with strategies, you know, all day long. But if it doesn't fit the place and the culture of the place, then what's that point, right? I mean, unless they want to change the culture of the place. Do people ever call you in for that? We are trying to change the culture of this school.
Yeah, people call us in.
Can you help us?
Yeah, people call us in for that all the time, David. That happens, but it's one of the things that we advise leaders all the time. You know, is that if you really want to change culture, there are better ways to change culture. Strategy is not the way to change culture. You can steer the ship in a different direction. You know, look, I mean, you can create the strategy that steers the ship in a different direction, but if the culture is not able and willing to move with you in that new direction, your strategy is not going to succeed. It's kind of like the ship only follows what the captain and the shipmates are able to really kind of do, correct? So you got to really think about, first and foremost, when you do strategy, is your culture aligned? Because if your strategy is not aligned with culture, it's not going to work. But I think it makes a particular point, because I think the reason I say, when you ask about what metacognition does, the reason I start with culture is because we actually get brought in quite a bit to do strategy work. But I always want to make sure that people understand that we can do strategy work if the culture is not aligned, and that what we really need to come in and what you and we need to really partner on is, hey, for what you want to accomplish and where the organization needs to go, is the culture set up to be able to follow and lead in that direction?
And just sort of closing the piece about metacognition. I don't know where it was, but I read something about it being the sort of the anti-consultancy, that it's different. It's different from other organizations that offer services. And what is that difference? Is it the focus on culture?
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, that was actually, it's not something that we came up with, but it was a client, a CFO actually at a school a couple of years ago that we were working with, who said, look, you know, similar to what you said about not looking forward to the workshop before you encountered me. And, you know, the CFO said, look, you know what, you know, we work with consultants all the time. And when we signed up, we were like, oh, you know, it's going to be just one of the same old of what we already do with any number of people. And he said, I have to tell you, I wasn't excited, but now having worked with y'all, like, I am really happy and excited that we signed up with y'all, because I can see where you're actually not like other consultants. And he said, you're almost like the anti-consultancy. And what he meant in what he was sharing with us is that, you know, that a lot of experience that folks have with consulting and consultants is that they come in and they essentially have templates, and they basically just take templates that have worked in any number of other organizations and basically just do a copy and paste with minimal editing or tweaking for a different context. to your point about what makes us different is the focus on culture is because you recognize that context matters. And before you do anything on the strategy front, before you do anything with an organization, understanding the context is essential. And the context is really what the culture actually is and what we reference and where we essentially pull in. So our job and what we see as Metacognition is that we're going to not just simply bring in a template, we're actually going to really understand what you need. And if we need to design something from scratch, we're going to partner with you to create something both in terms of process and outcome that is typically uniquely yours and not something for others. So and we can bring in lessons, but we're not just simply doing a copy paste.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, if you want me to edit this out, I can, but I'm really curious. Does that mean you guys spend more time? Like, you know, somebody will hire a consultant and they may be expecting this is going to take a week or this is going to be, you know, once a month for X number of months. But because you put so much emphasis on working with and understanding the place you're working with, well, you know, that often takes time.
You're absolutely correct. And you don't need to edit this out, David. I mean, we have turned down projects and proposals when, you know, like I remember a head of school about 6 months ago came to us and said, hey, you know, we want to do a strategic plan. And I asked about what's the timeline, and the head of school shared, well, you know, the board and I would like to start, you know, let's say in the next month, and we would like to be done 5 months from now. And I said to this head of school, I said, I'm sorry. I said, but that's just not the way we work. And that's just not how our process works, you know, and I can explain exactly why, what is the time that we will take, where we will spend time to really understand who you are, what you need, and make sure that we are research-based, we are data-informed, you know, that we are really understanding the cultural elements and context before we go and help you develop your strategy. And so we turn away projects if people ask us to come in and do things that we don't think are actually values aligned and appropriate for us and what we believe are non-negotiable. Like, I'm okay turning people away.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned the word values line, and that was one of the, it's down further on my page of notes, but tell me if I'm wrong about this, but as I read through the website, you know, the things you write, et cetera, I don't know how to put it. I want to use the word values or morals, right? There's a lot of, a strong message of morality. And I don't mean that in like moralism, like, you know, right and wrong and shaking your finger at people, but, you know, there's language in there about making the world a better place, strong convictions. And so I guess I want to invite you to speak about that aspect of what you're doing, and or else tell me I'm wrong about that, but it's different. It's different. That is a different flavor. It has a from other places.
Yeah. I mean, I think, David, you know, I did not become a consultant by intent. You know, it was not my goal to go into consulting and start a consultancy. It really came about completely accidental. And frankly, because of COVID, I found myself not able to pursue the plans that I had at the time. And because I could not pursue the plans I had at the time due to COVID, and just simply what COVID was doing in summer 2020 around the world, I ended up starting Metacognition entirely by accident. I did not want to grow a team. I did not want to do this forever. I still don't think I want to do it forever. But what I said in the moment is that if I'm going to do this, that, you know, to me, what became important is that I need to make sure that if I'm going to do something I don't want to do, then it needs to work for me. And if it doesn't work for me, then I'm happy and I am willing, more than willing, to step away from it. So I really had to get very clear about what are the values that are going to make this a fulfilling role, a fulfilling job, more importantly, fulfilling work for me, given that I don't and I say this very publicly and transparently, I don't have a high measure or a lot of respect for consulting and consultancies as a profession or as organizations. So I was like, well, if I'm going to be one of those, then I need to make sure that I'm proud of who I am and what I do at the end of the day. So, you know, one of the first blog posts that I wrote in December of, I think, 2022 now was basically, and it's just labeled choices. And I just essentially kind of laid out what our values are and particularly how I think about the work that we do. And for one of the first things in there is we choose the people, not the projects. And to me, that was really important because I felt that, you know, consulting is very much project-based, project-driven. But again, goes back to what you said about that the work that we do and how we do it takes time. And I felt that was really important that in the end, it's not about the project. It's actually about the partnership. It's about the partner. It's about the people. And that is absolutely one of those things that I would say is, to your point, moralistic or values aligned, is that we think very carefully and deeply when we are selecting who we are going to work with. It's not just what we will work with, but who we will work
with. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's sort of, at least in my mind, it begs the question. Well, I don't know if it's the question or the topic. I know from looking at the work you've done and the brief conversation we had, you've done a bunch of work in the DEI world, right? I mean, for both individual schools, I think, and also for, you know, NAIS and associations of schools. So it's, and now we live since January, maybe more, maybe earlier, but certainly since January of this past year, where things that we value, things that seem valuable, like, geez, people are different and we should somehow acknowledge that and welcome that and equity. Well, geez, that sounds like a good fairness and justice, and isn't that good? And inclusion. Well, you know, should we want people to feel excluded? Do we want anybody to feel not? So it's a different world we live in now. And I'm wondering, both, has that changed your work? And how do you think about that? How do you think about, like, you know, do you think it's just this passing fog that will, like so much fog, blow off? Or yeah, is it going to change the face of schools, independent or otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, David, you raised some really great questions. Even 5 years ago when I started Metacognition in summer of 2020, you know, one can argue, right, that back in summer of 2020, because of what was going on in the country at that time, the pendulum, if you will, had swung in one direction. And now in 2025, you know, the pendulum seems to have swung in the other direction. And even back then in summer of 2020, 2021, when there was a lot of momentum, you know, behind this work, and a lot of people, a lot of organizations were wanting to do this work and dive in and even make public commitments to do this work, we were one of the consultancies. And in fact, really, at least in the independent school world, I would say one of the few, if any, consultancies that were actually telling people, you got to commit to process, don't commit to outcomes. Let the outcomes emerge from the process. A lot of organizations, even corporations, were coming out at that time, you know, with a long list of commitments, but there was no process. And what we were telling people is that that's not going to work. You may think that you have people right now on board, but you haven't actually engaged them in a process to get them on board. And especially if it feels like suddenly you were about one thing today and you're about something else tomorrow, people will reject it no matter how good the ideas may be. So we were actually the ones advocating for process. We were the ones at the time, even 5 years ago when the pendulum was in the other direction, advocating for cultural alignment before you create the strategy. Right? We were the ones who were really advocating for that. You got to make sure that before you do anything, that it needs to pass two particular criteria. One, is it authentic to you and your organization? You got to ask the question, why here? The second question is it intentional? Why now? before you do anything strategic and before you create any kind of a sustainable plan, you got to make sure that it passes the litmus test of authenticity and intentionality, because if it doesn't feel authentic and it's not intentional, it will not survive. It cannot be work that is going to feel meaningful. So that is something that we were saying even 5 years ago. To your point about, is it a passing fog? I think, David, here is the problem I have with the way that at least out there, you know, that DEI work is perceived. And it does, I do think that there is some truth to the way it is perceived in ways that I think there has been this backlash against it. And it's because a lot of consultants and a lot of people advocating for DEI work went in and go in with a mindset, even if it's not necessarily explicit or intentional on their part, they go in with that sense of a zero-sum game. And zero-sum game cannot and will not be acceptable to any group, any individual, because a zero-sum game assumes that it's a win-lose proposition.
Right.
And absolutely. So when you think about the irony that if you go in and talk about DEI work with a zero-sum mindset of a win-lose proposition, that assumes that for me to be included, you got to lose.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's not going to work. So we have never advocated for that. And we have been very clear, and we have worked, done a lot of work with organizations all over the United States and abroad, including corporations. So you talked about that, you know, we do a lot of work with schools. We actually did some of this work with an industrial automation company. We actually helped them. And one of the reasons the CEO and the board of this industrial automation company, of which, by the way, I know nothing about, right? That's not my content area.
They didn't bring you in for that.
Correct. Correct. But they were going through a strategic plan, and they liked our approach that it has to be culturally aligned, that it has to be authentic and intentional, and that the plan that they would develop for this work would not be someone else's plan. It would be their plan. And it would be something that they can recognize internally, because that's critical. That's what's most important.
Yeah.
There's a lot more I could say about that, but, you know, I think that's good.
And please feel free. It's tricky territory in that, you know, there was a historical reason. There is an historical reason for the emergence of that.
Yes.
Of that, you know, that felt need that sort of, not by everybody, obviously, but the felt need, this upswell of, wow, we really need to open doors here, right? Because a lot of people have been turned away before they even get to the door. And so outcome, or at least a direction, matters. On the other hand, if it's forced, right, if people are not brought along, then doomed, from my point of view, doomed to failure, right? You can't shove those things down people's throat. In fact, the fact that there was such an enormous need is evidence that you can't just shove that down people's throats, right? And at the same time, it matters, right? So there is a tension there. And, you know, I always trust tension. I think healthy tensions have always been rich territory, you know, for people to be able to operate in. So, you know, and my hat's off to you for that approach. I'm also, you know, it reminds me, as you were describing it, it reminds me of, you know, when the world, which is to say the westernized world, suddenly discovered the environment. And, you know, every commercial from the oil companies to didn't matter who it was green. Everybody was becoming green. Everybody was green. They've always been green. We've always been green. It's like, wait, you're actually the reason that people need to be green.
Correct. Correct.
So it's sort of like that.
You're absolutely right. And I think that that's where, you know, one of the things, you know, that we have been advising over the last few months to the organizations that we work with is to help them continue to clarify that, one, make sure that it's mission aligned, right? whatever you do always needs to be organizationally mission aligned, because otherwise people will reject, especially if it just feels something new that you've brought in. It's kind of like the body rejects blood that is not compatible with its own blood type, right? Yeah. That's the way that I think about the culture strategy interplay, right? It's like the body is very clear about what is compatible with itself, and organizations are similar to it, like biological organizations. I feel like, you know, there is a biology to our schools and other organizations too. But I think the other piece, David, I would say is that what we have been telling these organizations that we work with is you got to also explain that diversity is the outcome, right, of excellence. It's not just simply the input, but it's also the output. So too often, I think, you know, we think of as if diversity needs to be the priority or equity needs to be the priority. And of course, what people then bristle against is that, wait a minute, if that is the priority, then you are somehow undermining excellence as a core value or a virtue, right? As opposed to, no, the two of them are very deeply interconnected. That we can't have excellence without diversity. We can't have diversity without excellence.
Right.
And definitely, you know, in real terms, right, in real life, the way that it plays out is that if we think about it, actually high-performing teams, high-performing cultures, high-performing organizations are actually diverse at their core, because we realize that sameness is not going to push you as far, is not going to level up, it's not going to challenge, as much as having a diversity of voices, tenures, abilities, capacities, all kinds of things at the table with you.
Well, and I think, I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know the data on this, but I think it took a lot of convincing to get to that understanding. I don't mean for you. I mean, in the world, right? I mean, it was, you know, there was homogeneity breeds a certain sort of stupidity sometimes, right? Or at least a blindness, right? I mean, you don't see what you can't see because everybody's nodding their head at the same time. And that must mean we're doing okay, because well, look at us. We're all doing fine, right? Right. And so, you know, if only we could stop the pendulum.
I know.
At the rich points along the path, rather than the extremes, rather than as results of zero-sum games.
Yeah,
the world would be a better place.
It's the other piece, David, is that, you know, what we are also telling folks is, you know, that remember that diversity is the outcome. So, you know, what does that mean? That excellence is the virtue and the core value. You should never compromise on demanding and expecting excellence, right?
Right.
So right. You can't lead with right. One of the reasons why there was a backlash has been is because people felt that somehow, again, we put diversity, equity, inclusion work at the top, right. And therefore we diminish the need or demand or expectation for excellence. I think, and I do believe that unfortunately that is true in terms of what happened in many other places. And again, you know, therefore, realistically, there has been this backlash. Now, you know, the other piece that we also tell people is that, and this is, again, a counter to what is happening in so many places and has happened in the last few years, is don't assume that diversity is an absolute term or has an absolute definition. I think for too many people, it became one of those absolute things that regardless of culture, context, team, or need, that diversity means I need more people of color, or diversity means I need more people of this background or that tenure or voice or perspective, as opposed to, no, you got to make it super concrete and specific to your context, to your culture, to your team. So when you're hiring, let's just take that as an example, you got to look at what is the current state of your team? What are the current needs on your team? What does your strategy say about where you're going in the next 3 to 5 years? What expertise and experience and perspective do you already have? And what are you lacking? And therefore, what and how do you prioritize that need when you're going out there and looking for someone, right? Automatically, you do it that way in nothing that I have said. You know, I've said like, oh, it needs to be about DEI and people of color or some particular background or perspective. It's actually starting with, again, what is your need? what does your team already have and where they are capacitated? What are you lacking in terms of perspective and competence? And how do you prioritize that for your context as opposed to something objective or absolute? Because it is not objective and it is not absolute.
Exactly. You know, and well, we all know what has unfortunately turned into sort of, you know, these sort of idiotic measures. They're not really even measures. They're just like check boxes. You know, okay, how many people of color do you have? What color? How many? I mean, like, you know, and it becomes, it actually became a, it was so easy to become a tool of opposition.
Correct.
But really? It was sort of, how about eye color? And what, like, what should I care about? Height? What should I care about?
That's right. That's so, right. That's yeah. right.
So
now, it's a very, very interesting times that we live in, but I think we need to get very clear about any number of things. And I think, you know, too often, I think, David, these terms, and we started with a definition of culture. We're talking about DEI. We are talking about any number of things. I think it goes back to, do we have clarity of when we say, so when you say culture and when I say culture, do you and I, if we are in the same organization, yeah. the same team, do we mean the same thing? And I think we assume that people know what each of us is saying, when actually I think we need to spend time really clarifying before we just assume that we all know what we are saying. We are speaking English, but the definitions might be different.
And when you walk into an organization and you do what you do to bring that to the surface, to reveal that.
Yeah.
Do you do certain things with groups? We only met for that one day, but do you do certain things to groups to sort of, to allow them to get familiar with what that culture is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a number of things. And again, you know, this should feel familiar because it's a lot of what folks do. It's a combination of really first and foremost, starting with an organization's own data, right? What is the data that you have collected over the last 3 to 5 years? What kind of questions are you curious about and have you asked? You know, one of the things that we want to understand when we walk in is, how does the leadership of the organization see itself? Right? What does the leadership of the organization prioritize? You know, what do they consider as the leaders of that organization of what is signal versus what is noise? Right. Because part of what we are trying to understand is, how do you calibrate yourself within the institutional context? Right? And then based on the data that you have and what you classify as signal versus noise, you know, how do you describe your culture and how do you describe the gaps in your culture and in your strategy? And really try to distill it to, what are the 2 to 3 research questions or strategic questions that you're really curious about as we walk in, right? That then helps us, as we both understand your own perspective, we are also then starting to look through the data through our own lenses and perspectives and trying to understand kind of like what's going on. And we use that as a jumping off point to really actually define and curate a set of interview questions and curate a set of focus group questions. And this is qualitative research now, and we're stepping into the qualitative space to really surface what trends and themes continue to arise when we speak to the different stakeholders. And, you know, there are a set of guidelines and instructions that we give to the leaders to say, like, here are the focus groups. Here is what the composition of the focus groups. Sometimes it might be some one-on-one interviews instead of focus groups or in addition to, but basically we walk them through. And in qualitative research, there is a rule of thumb, which is, it's the 80-20 rule, that you'll get about 80% of the insights by talking to 20% of the people. So we want to make sure that we are speaking to a representative sampling, if you will, of the different stakeholders. And then when those themes and trends surface, we are able to add it to the existing research and data that the institution had already provided us. And we use all of that to inform the design of surveys that are stakeholder specific and would go to specific stakeholder groups in the organization. And when we get into surveying, this is where we are moving now from qualitative to quantitative research. And it's really important in research methodology, you actually do qualitative, then quantitative. You don't do both simultaneously. And you also don't do one survey for all the stakeholders. You actually do very stakeholder specific surveys because you really want to tie into their experience of their context in that organization. We do all of that. And at the end of it, you know, we are able to deliver a report, David, that basically gives us kind of like what we call like a culture map. It's literally like a topographical map of the cultural terrain of that organization.
I'm curious, have you ever gotten invited into an organization, whether it's a school or, you know, a corporation or, you know, a for-profit organization, whatever you work with, and you get invited in for this thing. And what reveals itself is that you can't even get to the this thing question because what has surfaced is, you know, you walk into the CEO or the leader's office and say, look, you got a different problem than you thought you had.
Yeah.
Have you ever had that?
Yeah. Yes. And I would say almost every organization, you know, there is something that surfaces over the course of the research, you know, that not necessarily I would say that is a surprise to the CEO. I think, you know, we try really hard to make sure that nothing that we deliver is a surprise. So we're really managing expectations and communications throughout. But a lot of it is because as the story or the narrative, the map is being developed or curated, you know, we're also communicating with that CEO. And so we do try to tell, you know, like, hey, you might have thought that this is a lower priority. This is actually showing up more intensely in the data than perhaps where you had calibrated that priority or that question. Or here is the nuance, if you will, because the CEO or the head of school or the executive director may have a sense of kind of what's going on, but they may not know to what level and to what depth is some of that happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what ends up happening in the course of the conversation and the engagement is, you know, we try to get really clear, really concrete, but it happens frequently, more frequently than one would imagine, where we go in and where they may have calibrated their priorities are different from what the data shows or reveals.
Right. I get it. That's both interesting and juicy. And I wonder what's going through the leader's mind when then there's how they're sort of scrolling through that. Geez, what are we going to say to the board?
Yeah. Well, and David, I think, you know, this is where I think it goes back to the values alignment that you referenced earlier, right? Which is we choose the people, not the project. So we
yes.
really think deeply about the partner on the other side that we would be reporting to. Working with, and is this person someone who already has a preconceived notion or preconceived ideas about where they want to go? Because even during the proposal process, we will actually tell the CEO or the executive director or head of school, look, if you already know where you want to go, don't hire us and don't spend your time and money on us because it's not going to work. But if you're genuinely curious and if you're genuinely open to, you know, following the research and following the data and committing to process. Like I said at the very beginning, even 5 years ago on the DEI front, when we were telling folks, commit to process, not to outcomes, we consider ourselves and our superpower to be the process. Because to us, what feels really important is that the way that you calibrate the pace and the way you calibrate priorities or set priorities is by really having the right people at the table, having a clear process in place and allowing the priorities and the pace to emerge from the people and the process. So to us, that partnership is really important because, again, if you know where you want to go, more power to you, good, just go do it. Don't engage in any kind of a performative process with us because we can't do that performative stuff.
Get it. That's I have to say, I mean, I'm taken back to that Saturday together. From my point of view, you think about this in such an interesting and rich way. It's a much better thing. Well, finally, it's actually, I'm lying about this. It's not finally. I have another question as well. Is there low-hanging fruit in organizations? Do you notice a pattern where most organizations are either, I don't want to think about them necessarily as making mistakes, but are making choices that, the same sorts of choices, that are not serving the organizations? Is there a cluster of those things?
Yeah, I mean, it's another great question. I'm sure after our conversation, it might come up with three or four other things. But I think the thing, David, that comes to mind is, and I'll explain tactically how this shows up. But I think, you know, for leaders in particular, I think too much of the focus at times is on time management And really, I think, you know, the focus needs to be more on attention management. You know, manage your attention, not your time. You know, to me, managing one's attention is strategic. Managing time is tactical. And so what I mean by that, for example, is when I was a head of school and leading a team and leading a community, I really, you know, started to shift, you know, for example, the meeting agendas for our leadership team weekly check-ins away from the tactical calendar, you know, what's happening tomorrow week and so on, to really starting to elevate the strategic mindset and competence of the leadership team. And a norm that I had for us as a team was we practice leadership every time we meet. I was not going to outsource the leadership development and growth of the individuals on my team to a three-day conference once a year. And to me, I feel that low-hanging fruit is actually where I think leaders, when they think about their meetings, when they think about their meeting agendas, really need to ask a couple of questions. One, whose meeting is it? I think that's really important. I think too often, I think people go into a meeting not clear about actually who's running the meeting. You know, I think the second thing that leaders, I think, also need to think about is, you know, do we need to make any decisions? And if we need to make any decisions, then whose decision is it?
Right. Oh, I think that's, you know, I really wish we had had the opportunity in the past to work together. We are so simpatico. And I remember days when I would walk into meetings and say, here's what we're going to be talking about today. And I want to make sure this is, from my point of view, I really want your input, but ultimately I'm going to make this decision or not. You know, at the end of this meeting, we're going to vote. So.
Correct. And I used to talk about the difference between voice and a vote. Just because I give you a voice does not mean you have a vote.
Absolutely. Right?
And again, I think, you know, so I think that's second. I think the third, David, and the third one I think I would say is that I think every leader in any meeting, any conversation needs to be asking, whose job am I doing right now? Mm-hmm. Am I doing my job or am I doing someone else's job? And I think those questions are actually very low-hanging fruit because, you know, too often what ends up happening is, again, we're not managing our time and attention effectively. We're not really thinking about what is the desired outcome of any of the conversations that we are in or called to. And we're not necessarily always clear for ourselves or for others on our teams and in our community what their job is and what my job is.
Right. Right.
And if we can just bring clarity, I think, to those things, whose meeting is it? Whose decision, if there is a decision to be made, and whose job are you doing? I think right there, these seem very simple questions, but they are super profound when put into practice and when practiced daily.
That sounds super wise. And I want to underline that again, that is obviously relevant to schools and educational communities. But it's not just schools and educational community.
Any organization, any leadership, you know.
Absolutely. Well, okay, now I'm going to stop lying. So this is actually my last curiosity, my last question. So you said at the beginning, this was you. You know, you said you're not sure you want to do this forever. So does Metacognition wouldn't be a bad name for a school, by the way. So does Nishant Mehta ever think about going back to the actual nuts and bolts of a particular school community? It may not exist yet.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. Correct. One, not existing schools as they exist yet.
Yeah.
Might I go and do the nuts and bolts to your point of running an organization? Very possibly. I think, David, I am at a stage and a phase where, and I think this is a great place to perhaps end on because of your, you reference my name, I reference your name now. I'm at a great stage and phase of my life and career where I am literally all I'm doing every day and I try to do is pursue my curiosity. You know, I try to learn. I try to make sure that no matter what I do and whatever I will do is always going to continue to feed my curiosity and creativity. That it is going to help me be a better leader, that it is going to help me be a better partner to others, and that I am at a place as well where that curiosity I'm actually starting to pursue it outside of the school world. So I don't know if I would necessarily go into only education or only working with educators, because we are working with other nonprofits and we are working with corporations as well as we develop our own processes and expertise, and others realize that what we do is very applicable across any number of industries. So to me, curiosity is paramount. It's the non-negotiable. And I don't know the answer to your question, but all I can say is that whatever I do, I think you can rest assured that it will be because I'm curious about it. And therefore, I decided to do that.
That's great. That's great. Well, if something emerges from this, that's exciting. And I'll look forward to a time when we can have another conversation.
100%.
So thank you so much again for doing this.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.